You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket Live with Simon Mann and Angus Fraser. Here's a bit of music for you just to introduce the show. You should be familiar with that, actually, if you're podcast viewers or listeners. This is a little bit of a tune which was made for me by a friend, Matt Cooper, who's a musician with the Incognito band, and he tried to make it sound a little bit like the I Wish tune of Stevie Wonder. So that was our attempt to be musicians, anyway, or my attempt. Maybe we should cut that and just welcome Angus Fraser to our virtual club and everyone else as well who's joined us. Sorry for the delay. It was mainly my fault for not being able to work out the technology and getting Angus on screen. You'll be familiar with disorganisation from me, Gus, won't you?
Yeah, I'm just surprised you didn't throw me under the bus, though. You normally do in those situations.
Also, you said mainly, Yosa. Mainly? Don't you mean 100%?
I had a bad reputation in the Middlesex dressing room, did I not, Gus, for people keeping well out of my way because a lot of tea got spilled and my kit. I was one of those classic students who had all my kit scattered in all directions, and people gave me a wide berth. It was great
amusement that we saw you turn up on television as the analyst when you're the most disorganised cricketer I think
you shouldn't give that away now. You know, I've got some dedicated fans here. You've just completely ruined my reputation.
You're
anyway,
a shambles.
I hope you can see my nice Middlesex jumper that I've worn especially for the occasion, especially to welcome you onto our show. But a big welcome to everybody who's patiently waited those few minutes in the green room or in the queue for us to finally start. We'll gradually get this a little bit slicker, but Simon's here as well, and he's been patiently waiting for me to try and sort this out. We're going to talk tonight about Middlesex and obviously about England, and we're going to talk about the life of a director of cricket, actually, which is what you are, Gus, and how you've converted from playing to journalism and now to sort of administration in a way. Actually, what we want to know ultimately is what a director of cricket actually does. I'm not accusing you of not doing anything, but that would be an interesting thing to find out. We have mentioned about a prize and a competition. Hopefully you've got a question lined up for later, Gus.
I have, yes.
Yeah, good. So we're going to sort of test you out with sort of knowledge or your guesswork. And I have a prize ready. In fact, I've got a few prizes. One of them is this, which is, I don't know if you can see that, but this is a signed cricketer front cover signed by Ben Stokes commemorating the World Cup win. We actually printed 11 different covers on the cricketer when we won the World Cup, one for each player. And I got a lot of them signed. So that is one prize that we can win, sort of almost replicating the idea of a club dinner. There's lots of you out there who'll be regular club players or club attendees in some way, and you're not going to be able to to get to club dinners as much or club get-togethers as much this winter. So that, one of the reasons why we're doing this live show is to try and keep the cricket conversation going and bring you all in to the cricketing community. Gus, firstly, I just suppose I could point out behind you, one of the great things about these videos is getting into people's homes and finding their total chaos of their the room where they work. I've got Rajasthan Royals shirt up there, actually, to my right, your left. And over there, a Durham, an old Durham shirt, which I might be able to show you. You probably can't see because I'm in the way. But anyway, some memorabilia knocking around. Gus, you've got a very fine collection of Wisdens there. How many have you actually got? Is that just to replicate your career?
Yes, it is. It's the Wisdens where I think I feature in. Although, saying that, I think it stops at 98. So that probably ends where I was useful on a cricket field and not hanging in there for a year or two extra. But, yeah, there's a few Wisdens there. Books. I'm not really allowed much cricket memorabilia around the house. My wife Denise won't sort of tolerate that. So anything that's there is upstairs or hidden.
You used to have bags and bags of kit from different tours and different teams, didn't you? What ever happened to all that in the end?
Yeah, I think a lot of, I suppose you get two types of cricketers. One that throw their kit away at the end of every season and sort of expect a new lot to be delivered. I'm a bit of a hoarder, so I used to sort of keep stuff. So up in the loft, there's a Middlesex shirt for every different sponsor that we had, the same for England tours or England summers that I played in. And again, quite a bit of kit that I've swapped with players over the years. But it's got nowhere to show, so it's just sat in bags and in a chest of drawers up above me there in the loft, really.
I'd love to know which cricketer has the most kit, you know, from the different franchises. Someone like Tendiscarty, he played millions of different franchises. Someone like Wayne Bravo, Dwayne Bravo, Imran Tahir. I bet he's got a few. Chris Gayle's played for about three or four different IPL franchises. Did anyone see? I don't know if anyone saw the IPL tonight. Actually, Simon, you were not convinced that it was all that genuine in a way, were you?
No, I wouldn't go that far. But I mean, it was, amazingly, it went to the last ball, even though it looked as if the Kings 11 Punjab were winning that for just about the whole 20 overs of their innings. They've had a terrible time of it. Gayle in tonight, made a half century, but somehow managed to take it to the last ball, got himself run out, and it went to the last ball, and then the last ball was hit for six to save everyone from a super over. You know, you're just thinking of those television ratings, just sort of keeping people hanging on in India. Well, it probably did that tonight.
Who knows how many people, how many sixes Chris Gayle has hit? Put that on the chat. So if you are new to this technology, as obviously we are, you can enter questions, as some of you already are, on the chat box there. And you can also enter comments to each other as well. So it's great to see Fothers is there again. Good to see you, Fothers, former wicketkeeper for Durham. I hope you admire the fact that I've got a Durham shirt there hanging on my wall, which was from our first year in the 50-over competition. Phil Veazey, thanks for coming. Jeff Wellstead, John Hooper, and others. Please say hello on the chat. My question is, how many sixes has Chris Gayle hit in the IPL? Enter that on the chat box and see if one of you gets it right. That isn't the official question for tonight, a competition. It's just a little beginner, starter for 10, if you like. How many sixes has he hit? It's an astonishing number. And he hit about four more today. So it's an amazing performer. So, Gus, tell us about your season. A weird season, a season that at times looked as if it wasn't going to start, but in the end got underway. You had to play a lot of your home matches, Middlesex home matches at Radlett, and had to put unusual things up, marquees and things for changing facilities and so on. So when you sort of review it, as I'm sure you have over the last couple of weeks or so, what do you think of it?
You go back to this time last year when you're sort of planning for this season, aren't you? And trying to negotiate a pre-season tour. So you go to Oman on a pre-season tour, you come back early in a rush because of lockdown and all the things that are happening COVID related. You sit there then wondering what's going to happen April, May, June. Are we going to play any cricket? There was one sort of false-ish oh, not false start, but one suggesting that might start in July. I don't think anybody treated that seriously. It just seemed to be a name that was plucked out. But then all of a sudden, the August, the first date was mentioned, and there seemed to be some energy behind that. So you're then almost working back from there, really. And how long does it take to get your players fit, ready, and prepared for the summer? And again, during those 3 months before you actually get out there training with the players or devising schedules, and everything is sort of following the government protocols, which are changing all the time. We've actually worked very hard with the players to, I suppose, to look after their mental well-being. And I think that's the thing that everybody's scared about, or fears, and rightly so, the emotional well-being of your employees, your cricketers. And we worked really hard by having lots of meetings, lots of check-ins, some social things, doing things through Zoom, and also training, voluntary training, so Pilates, strength and conditioning sort of sessions. They were out running, and to be fair, most of them sort of got stuck into that. And when they came back in July, they were in reasonably good nick. And I suppose that's one of the reasons why the only real injury we had when we started playing was to Toby Rowland Jones, which was a shoulder injury, but everybody else seemed to come through it well. So we had a pretty good lockdown. The season, I think counties sort of viewed the season in different ways. Some were quite hard-nosed in that we're going to use the same philosophy as every other season, which is to go out there, win every game, play our strongest side. And I suppose you look at a couple of the teams, they've got very settled sides. They've been competitive. They've been winning or competing for the title for a couple of years, like Essex and Somerset. And they were quite hard-nosed and sort of played their strongest sides. And others sort of really did try and use it as a period to look at some youngsters and to give some youngsters a go. And I suppose we were in the middle, that we want to be competitive and win, but equally we want to have a look at a few young players. And we did that. So I was
some young players came through, actually, didn't they? Some one or two talented. There's that leg spinner and a couple of batters, and the guy who opened the bowling a little bit towards the end. There was some quite promising that leg spinner. I've forgotten his name now. Actually,
Luke Holman. But
yeah, he did well.
And, I mean, again, I suppose in first class cricket, Tilan Walawalita, a left arm spinner that's come through the youth system. He actually played as our second overseas player, or he played as an overseas player, because we're still going through the process. I mean, it's ridiculous when you see that a number of South Africans are sort of getting English citizenship, or the ability to play next summer as a local player because of who they've married or whatever. And we've got a young lad here who's been living in the country for 10 years and he's been part of our academy, and we're struggling to get him to become a citizen to play as a local player. But hopefully that'll be the case next year. So he played in 5 games and got some really good experience. Blake Cullen, a young fast bowler. Jack Davis, he also made his debut. And in 2020 cricket, as you said, there was Joe Cracknell and Luke Holman. And the lovely story there is that they're two young cricketers from North Middlesex Cricket Club who've been in our youth system. But, I mean, North Mid, when I was coming through playing for Stanmore, were, I don't know, not a major club as such. And they've had some problems. They no longer control their pavilion. Which is quite a big
thing. Is that your club, Simon?
North London was my club, but it's in the same area. There's about 5 clubs in that Shepherd's Cot Trust area in North London. They were one of them. Yeah, I mean, I played a few games against North Mid, but Gus was right. A while back, they weren't one of the big clubs in London, not by any means.
But they've become a real flagship in the country, in the way that they've invested in young players, they've played young players. They've supplied us with these two, Joe Cracknell and Luke Holman. Ethan Bamber's from there too. There's another young fast bowler called Max Harris who plays for North Mid too. So you've got this sort of little, and they've won the league a couple of times, and it's a really good place. I went down there a couple of Saturdays during the summer, and to see all the players, including the Middlesex players, at the end of the game pushing the sight screens around, tidying the ground up and make sure and it was okay for the following day. They've got a really good culture down there, and it's lovely to see those cricketers coming through.
Gus, a question from Sean Fisher. I mean, just on the championship, we had the Bob Willis Trophy. Do you favour 2 divisions or a 3 conference county championship. I mean, it still seems to be up in the air. We don't quite know what's going to happen next summer. I mean, in all sorts of ways, obviously. But what do you feel about the way the championship should be played?
I'm a sort of a bit of a geek on these things. In the way I tried, I suppose, probably being a journalist for 7 or 8 years and wanting to look at things quite closely. And I suppose you try and understand why two divisions came in. And if you look in the 80s and 90s, England's win record was pretty ordinary. We weren't winning many games of cricket and it was a real concern. So what can we do? The county championship, as ever, normally gets a bit of criticism in these situations. We need to make the county cricket championship more competitive. The best should be playing the best. So we go to a two division and the introduction of central contracts. So I think England in the 80s and 90s won 22% of the test matches they played in. Between 2000 and 2020, that rose to 44%. So the central contracts and the introduction of a two-divisional county championship could deem to be successful. So England are winning games, which is extremely important. But there's a lot of bad behaviour by counties too in the way the contracts are being employed ahead of English cricketers, a reluctance to play young cricketers, some counties nicking youngsters from other counties, poor pitches, I suppose the rise in salaries of players, which we all want to earn more money of course, but not at the cost of sort of or to risking the future of a county and things, or putting counties in difficult positions. So there were some poor behaviours on the back of that, and I always sort of look at it a bit deeper in the fact, how do you measure the strength or the health of English cricket? Is it by the number of games England win, or is it by participation and the number of people that are involved supporting playing the game? And if England have won, are winning more games now than they've ever won, yet participation and these numbers are very concerning. So therefore, why should every decision that the game makes be just to produce a stronger England side? Surely the game should also be looking after itself. And that's why I think in a roundabout way, I come away from a two-divisional county championship, even though I see the strengths of that in that the best are playing the best, to the conference system, where you give every county an opportunity of winning domestic cricket's major tournament each summer. So therefore, you've got 18 counties that start the season, because you're getting some counties that are getting pretty disillusioned with it all. They're not going to get in the first division or very hard. Their best players are getting pinched off them on an annual basis, and it becomes difficult for them to be competitive. And I think the fact that these counties then now have a chance of winning domestic cricket's biggest prize will allow them to hold on to their best players and to enter every season believing they've got a bit more to play for.
What do you think is going to happen then?
I think this coming season it's going to be three conferences of six again. I think just because
it's so uncertain, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's easier to control and to abbreviate or to sort of slightly adjust should COVID or things happen. I think it's an easier tournament for the ECB to sort of knock around and change a bit without it sort of affecting its integrity as significantly. And I think that will then be reviewed at the end of next season with a view to what are we doing in 2022? Is it going to be two divisions of eight or two divisions as previously, or do we stick with three conference system?
I'm just going to answer that Chris Gayle question. Could take you keep you off your suspense anymore. Finish your suspense. Frank Pello says 317. Alex Gaywood 520. Slightly over ambitious. Will Gould 350. Somebody there. Sean Fisher 331. It's actually 323, it might be 324. He three or four today. So 324 sixes. It's a lot more than either you or I hit, though, Gus, isn't it? Actually, you hit a few sixes in your time. I remember that that ridiculous game once. You remember that John Player League game, that Sunday League game, when we were chasing 50 off five? Simon Mann doesn't believe this, and neither does Jeffrey Boycott, who I spoke to the other day. And he said, I could face your bowling now with my stick and in my sweater and with a cup of tea in my hand and things like that. But he doesn't believe that you and I hit 50 to win off five overs against Kent, and we got it in four. And one of the bowlers was Richard Ellison.
We did. That was almost sort of a question I was thinking of asking, but I haven't gone there, thankfully. No. But do you remember one of us hit a six, and it was whether it just got over the line or not. And I can't remember who was the Kent captain, but he was livid that one of the Kent players sort of signaled six without, because he'd seen his game slip away from him. He wanted the umpire to make
nobody did the old thing that in those days of diving over the line and flicking it back. I mean, some of the fielding that I've seen in the IPL, we've seen Nicholas Pooran's save, diving full length, absolutely sort of horizontal to the ground and flicking it back in midair to save six. And oh God, it's just incredible. Which well, I'm the fielding, there. Go on, sorry.
The fielding's brilliant, but the trouble is, it means that the boundaries are shorter.
Much smaller, yeah.
Because we've got to give 10
people
feet.
About 10 yards to dive over.
No, you've got to give 10 feet between the boundary boards and the advertising, or the boundary foam, the rope and the advertising boards, now for player safety. And it's because they're throwing themselves like lunatics there. So, yes, they're saving some runs for the bowler, but he's probably going for half a dozen sixes more a summer because of it.
Yeah.
Here's a question from Jeff. I think it's Jeff Steed. The email address is Jeff Will Steed. But can we expect great things from, you know, with your Middlesex hat on, can we expect great things from Master Atherton now that he has a Middlesex contract? Mike Atherton's son, who plays for you, he just signed a contract for you. It's difficult, isn't it, where at a young age, and batsmen develop, I mean, cricketers develop at different ages. You know, you can look at some at 17 and think, oh, they're going to be a world beater, and they've fallen away by the time they're 22, and someone's a slow start at 20, think not sure, and then by the time they're 24, they're a test cricketer. You probably don't want to put pressure on him, but what do you feel about him? It's Josh, isn't it?
Yeah, he's bigger than his dad.
He is, of course, isn't he? Not Josh Atherton, Josh DeCaries. Yeah. That's his mother's surname. Yeah,
that's right.
He's got a few more shots than his dad.
That wouldn't be hard.
Yeah, they can hit the ball in the V rather than the A, which was Atherton's scoring sort of zone, wasn't it? Actually, it's funny when we've had conversations. I said, because he dropped me more. Everybody said he'd be best mate, but he dropped me for England more than anybody else when he was England captain.
That would have been always a good question, actually. Yeah,
it's always it was a gut feel. It's a gut feel, and I feel like, well, I can now reverse the role and leave his son out on a gut feel.
What power! What power you have! And
he's a cracking young. He's a really nice kid, and he can play. It's one of those ones we used this period again because. I mean, sadly, the volume of cricket played by cricketers at every level was restricted. And we said, well, how can we give our academy lads, the best of our academy lads, something worthwhile? So we got them involved in all our training sessions, and they were up at Radlett working and in the nets facing the first team. And he stood up very well in those training sessions and made a positive impression on Stuart Law. Sadly, I mean, the financial repercussions of what's taken place and what may be taking place over the next 12 months or so are going to have an effect on the game. And counties have got to, which I'm perfectly happy with, have got to look from within to produce young cricketers. So getting someone like Josh involved, who has definitely got something about him at this moment in time, was a very easy decision.
Chris Williams says, just arming on the county system and young players and just taking it on a bit. Does Gus see any merit in having a transfer market in the county game? I mean, do you mean actually paying transfer fees, Chris? Is that really feasible in county cricket? Is the money there anymore?
Not at the moment. I think before COVID, you could have argued that because the counties were getting bigger distributions than they've ever got before. The one area that, and I suppose, and it's without having to go at Gloucestershire,
which is Simon's county, so watch out.
I'm very aware of that. But if counties are sniffing around and looking at your young cricketers as saying they can give them opportunities that maybe other counties can't at that moment in time. I think certainly with young cricketers, if they've come through your loose system, you've developed them, you spend 7 or 8 years getting into a position where they've got a first or a county contract. I think there should be something some compensation that is given then if you're losing an 18, 19, 21-year-old or someone like that who you've invested in quite a lot, and at that moment in time you can't offer him the opportunities because of the makeup of your side that another county can. So I think something should be done there. And again, I suppose if you've got a player with 1 year left on his contract at the county, just the compensation could easily be the value of that contract, because that's his value to yourselves, isn't it?
It's interesting, actually, that the book I've written with Manoj Badali about the IPL and the future of the game, there's a story in there actually about the way that the Rajasthan Royals brought on a lot of young players, and one of them was Ravi Jadeja, who, you know, was just an 18-year-old, and Shane Warne as captain saw him and saw the potential to be a brilliant finisher and a bowler and all-rounder, brilliant fielder. And after about 3 years of playing for the Royals, the Chennai Super Kings spotted his ability, offered him and his family jobs for life, and poached him. And they had the Royals had no comeback on that, even though they'd invested 3 or 4 years of his youth to really develop him. I mean, it's a tough one. That Andy Fothergill, I must ask you a question that he's posted. Fothers, thanks for your participation. As I said before, he says to you, Gus, which batsman did you feel you could never get out?
Well, there are a few. Well, I suppose the best player that I've ever bowled at was Brian Lara. I mean, I think he's the greatest cricketer that I've played against. I mean, Shane Warne never got me out. I mean, I think he was overrated, actually. Lara was the best player.
Interestingly,
Michael Sclater, teed off and he went for you from the start and put you under a lot of pressure.
It's interesting your answer, Brian Lara, though, because I looked up your list of wickets, test wickets, 177 test wickets at 27, and actually your test average was slightly lower than your first class average, interestingly, with the ball. But your leading dismissal is Lara. You've got him 7 times in 15 attempts. So although maybe some of that was for 349 or something rather than for 12, but still it counts.
No, that was Andy Caddick. Caddick got him out for 375 and went running down the pitch like that as though we'd just taken a hat trick. And we said, Caddy, it's not your stage, this one. I think it's gone past that.
What did you say to Lara famously when you went past the edge when he was on about 320?
Well, I can't use exact language.
Family show.
But it was along the lines of, I suppose I can't call you a lucky so-and-so when you're on 320, can I? Because he played a miss to me twice in an over.
So Lara, Michael Sclater, two good... Sclater just looked so quite intimidating, actually. But at the same time, he was a bit frenetic, whereas someone like Matthew Hayden was genuinely intimidating.
Yeah, he was horrible.
But at least with Sclater, you felt you had a chance, I suppose.
I remember I sledged him once, and that was a waste of time. I say sledging me. I mean, Hayden. Sclater. I mean, he was a little fella, Michael Sclater, wasn't he?
But
and in the West Indies, they call sloggers cane cutters, don't they? Because you're going out. So I just kept calling him a cane cutter when he was edging one through slip and stuff like this. And all of a sudden, I've overpitched one slightly 6 inches outside of stump, and he's just mooshed it over mid off. One bounce into the advertising boards, and I'm sort of walking back to my mark. And all of a sudden, I'm aware of this sort of presence under my armpit, and it was him. And he's looking at me, and I said, "What are you looking at?" He said, "Just cutting another bit of cane, mate," and walked away.
Good line.
Yeah, didn't work.
Alex Gaywood says, in the 90s, I mean, you play, Gus? 46 test matches. You talk about being dropped by others a few times, and you had gaps out of the team. How much would you have benefited from central contracts? His question actually is, who do you think would have benefited most from a sort of more stable selection process and central contracts that we saw in the 2000s? Who would have benefited most in the 1990s when you were playing?
Well, I think Simon and I could probably look at someone like Mark Rambrakesh. I think he would have benefited hugely from that sort of backing and support rather than coming into an England side that sort of the selection was a bit not random, but it was certainly if you didn't perform for a game or two, you thought you were going to get dropped, that's for sure. I think I would have benefited hugely. I mean, yes. I mean, I'm happy I played when I played. I mean, whilst the money, the sort of the opportunities now are far greater than they were when I was sort of playing in the 90s, but it's not a nice place to be a lot of the time. The way that your game is forensically looked over by the analyst, the way that social media sort of reacts and how that all goes. It's tough now. I mean, you do get what you earn. You earn your money in many ways because of the things that you put through. So it was nice to play when we played in the way that there was you could have a bit of fun, you could be a fool, and you could get away with it, really, whereas you can't get away with anything now.
And Stuart Law, who we had on this podcast a while ago, our audio podcast, talking about mental health of players and the stresses that they experience now. I mean, he talked, and he's the Middlesex coach, of course, and he's also coached Bangladesh and the West Indies and, you know, had a lot of experience. And he said that, you know, the trouble with the modern player is they go straight to social media as soon as they come off the field, look at their Twitter and, you know, Instagram accounts and so on. The criticism that you get on that, which is inevitable if you have a bad day, is hard to handle, even though you know that you in yourself may feel confident that you had a bad day, but you can recover tomorrow. It hits home to you, doesn't it?
Yeah. My mum said to me towards the back end of my England career, she said, when you first played for England, I was the proudest mum in the world, but now I can't wait for it to end. Just because of them living it, they take... I mean, it is your parents and your family that are more upset by the insults and the criticism than you are. And again, you go into a dressing room or you sit there some days and you see players in tears at the back. And a lot of it is social media, what's being said, and the families, the mothers, they're really upset because some of the criticism and some of the things that are said in social media are horrible. Mm. And you don't sign up for that you're 18, you sign a professional contract, you're starting to make your way as a player. And I mean, some of these are members of Middlesex as well. I mean, the way they talk about people. I mean, I don't do social media because I couldn't trust myself. I'd tell someone their fortune straight away and be in front of a disciplinary board and told off. So I don't do it because I wouldn't take what people say. And I'd react and tell them exactly what I thought of them.
As director of cricket then, Gus, I mean, would you advise players to, you know, not be on social media and say, actually, you know, you think it's a good thing and everyone else is doing it, but actually it is only going to be damaging? Do you have that conversation with them?
Yes, you do. You equally tell them not to hook and do stupid things like that, but they still do it, don't they? And come running down the wicket to a left-arm spinner when it's turning. So, yeah, I mean, they can't help. I mean, it's part of their lives now, isn't it? And it's very difficult. You look at higher up the...
Look, we've got a special guest.
Oh, crumbs.
Look at that. I thought I'd just get him on just for a few minutes.
He looks as happy as ever.
Look at that.
I've been trying to work it out for the last half hour.
Well, Emma, so this is, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you recognize him.
My IT's not the best.
His IT's not the best. You look quite smart, though. In fact, you look like an air traffic controller there. You look as if you're going to, you know, call in a few planes coming into land. It looks very smart. John Embry, of course, for everyone who isn't familiar with the greyness of the beard and
the boiler's gone. So it's a boilers. It's a bit cold here. The boiler's gone down.
Oh, brilliant. It's great. Thank you very much for joining us, Embers. And one of the reasons I just wanted you to come on, really, was that you and Gus together were such a familiar and caustic pair.
Miserable.
Who loved each other, but you were always at each other as well. And yeah. I don't know what it was, you know, because you both had the highest... adopted the highest standards, expected the highest standards, and there was this mutual respect, and yet there was a mutual kind of antagonism always went on as well.
No, I think respect is the key. I think respect each other's ability and the skills that they brought to the game. And the dressing room at Middlesex was always a caustic one, even under Mike Brearley, and then into Gatt. And what Mike Brearley encouraged in the dressing room was a lot of people to voice their opinions, which when I first joined Middlesex, that wasn't the case with a lot of the older and senior players in the side. And I think Brearley allowed that to, he encouraged that. And that continued on for the first 12 years of my career at Middlesex until Gat took over. And it was just, then they just took over. And then we, then younger players came along, and I think everything became a little bit more liberal. And then, you know, you had people with lots more opinions than what we probably did. And I think the generation when Gus came along in the early part of the 80s with several other players, Tuffers and Ramps, and a young lad called Jamie Sykes. Jamie Sykes and Tuffers reminded me of Gordon Gatting, actually, when they first came into the dressing room in 1975.
So Ian Gould and Mike Gatting, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it was great because it was just a change of environment and everything was a bit breezy. Everyone, all of a sudden, you felt like you were a dressing room and everyone was making a contribution. And Mike really worked that very well. Mm. You know, he controlled it. He let go what he wanted to let go, monitored the individuals that might have been a little bit caustic in what they were in a dressing room. But actually, it was a very open dressing room, and a lot of people criticised Middlesex, say we argued on the field a lot. But what happened is we weren't always happy with each other's performance in the field. If there was someone that didn't make an effort, then that would be sorted out at lunchtime or tea time, and there'd be a lot of words said. And whatever person or player that aggression was aimed at, if he answered back, it was backed up by several other members in the side, so that the player knew that, you know, he was out of order. And although it could get very aggressive in the dressing room, I think the great thing with Breers and Gat is that that anger in the dressing room didn't fester. That anger got taken onto the cricket field and then was
channeled,
channeled into the opposition and not ourselves. And actually, it worked very well for us. I'm not too sure that would work well for a lot of other sides. And I remember one or two other players that came to Middlesex. I mean, Kevin Shine, coming from Hampshire to join us before going to Somerset, found our dressing room. He couldn't believe what was said and the criticism of senior players by younger players. Mm. He found that extraordinary. He thought that senior players were sacrosanct and that's it. You couldn't say anything. But in our dressing room, you know, everything went.
I think actually that's an interesting point. And there was a transition, I suppose, probably just sort of after I retired anyway, sort of mid-90s. And now, Gus, you probably can't have those sort of blunt, you know, you and Embers sort of having a go at each other, although there was mutual respect, that kind of environment can't exist now because people are much more sensitive, I suppose. Is that fair?
Yeah, I'd say that. And I think all coaches have had to sort of modify the way that they look after players. I mean, if you look at Premier League football, you'd say that your Pochettinos, your Klopps, I'm trying to think of the Man City manager, Guardiola, they're sort of looked on as sort of exceptional coaches. And they're very much working with the players. They're tough. And I think if the players cross them, then they're out the door quite quickly. But you're sort of Mourinho, who balls your players out, he looks a bit more of a dinosaur in comparison to them in the way that you're treating players. And yeah, the days of going in there and tearing a strip off players now is very difficult. I remember we went down to Tottenham, took our coaches down to Tottenham to sort of watch how they train and to see their facilities a few years ago, and Harry Redknapp was in charge there, and he was going on about this, and he'd sort of had a go at one of his players during half time because he didn't feel he'd been pulling his weight. And 20 minutes after the match finished, the player's agent's on the phone telling him he can't speak to his player. His player like that? And you're sort of thinking, where does he go with that sort of reaction? Because, yeah, I say anything that you say now gets out, and people have social media and things like that. So, you shouldn't be verbally abusing or sort of making members of your workforce look foolish in front of other people, but sometimes they do need a kick, and it's how you do it. Actually, the only way you can actually give an individual the kick that they need now is through selection. You just you don't pick them. That's the only way that you can tell them what they're doing is not good enough in a forceful way.
I was going to say to Gus, when you were a journalist, Gus, how easy did you find, or how difficult did you find it as an ex-player to be critical? I don't mean, you know, overtly critical and just, slamming a player, but to, you know, that those 7 years when you spent as cricket correspondent at the Independent, I mean, was that a huge change for you to go from playing to then writing about playing and having to make a judgment on a player or a match or whatever, or a team?
I think a little bit. There were a few times when I felt a bit guilty. When you push to a deadline and you've got to get it down and you haven't got the time to sort of truly consider what you've said. And sometimes they can actually be the best pieces you write because you just write what you're saying. You've got 20 minutes to get 600 words down or whatever, and you've just got to go for it. But more often than not, I was quite comfortable because I tried to be reasoned and think about all angles, where they've come from, and have they got it wrong. So if I was critical, I was normally quite comfortable. I got picked up a few times by some of the players, Michael Vaughan on a couple of occasions, but you're not going to keep everybody happy all the time, are you?
How did you deal with that? When Vaughan came up to you and said, "Oh, I didn't like that," what did you say to him?
If his argument had some merit, then I'd reason with it. If not, I'd say I don't sort of agree with where you're coming from there.
Actually, I got so used to, you know, players coming up to me going, "I thought you were my mate," when I wrote something slightly critical, that I was once driving back from a test match, Trent Bridge, having done the TV, and my phone went at sort of 11 o'clock at night, and it was an Australian voice. And I thought, oh God, you know, it's another criticism. It was a player sort of phoning up saying, "Oh, you've slagged me off, mate. Why did you do that?" And I said, "Who's this on the other end?" And he said, "It's Shane Watson." I said, "Oh God, okay. What have I said? What have I said about you kind of getting your pads in the way, LBW all the time and things?" He said, no, mate, I want some advice." I said, "What?" He said, I can't convert from 50 to 100. And he said, You study the game. You talk to loads of batsmen. And I just wanted to know what you think." And I thought it was a total wind-up. But actually, he was genuine. He wanted some advice about how to convert from 50 to 100. I said, "Well, I've only made 100. I've only made 100, and that was for school. But," and I sort of passed on a few ideas that I'd picked up from talking to, you know, KP or Cook or somebody like that. But you players are incredibly sensitive, aren't they? And I think that, I've got one other question, actually. Do you think that, therefore, in this modern environment, I would have been able to sue someone who said to me when I walked in to the photo call in 1991, when my wife had just decided to leave me for another man, and I said why I was late because of this sort of situation with my wife, and someone said, "Well, you're not exactly Richard Gere, are you?" Do you think maybe I could have sued that person now? Or maybe it was a totally justifiable remark.
The one time you were late, when you blamed the fact that you'd had three punches going to Worcester with Bill Edmonds' kit in the back of your car.
Yeah, that's true.
You weren't totally honest there, though, were you?
It was only one puncture. But it was true, actually. And I had Mike Gatting and John Embers. Embers' gear
in
my car. Yeah, and it was the captain and vice captain. And I turned up at 1 o'clock for a televised game and Gat had to toss up in his suit, which wasn't good. So, oh dear. So give us a little bit of a sense of your relationship, you two, Fraser and Embry. You were kind of, you know, you were at each other quite a bit, but there was that mutual respect. And there's, you know, I remember coming off the field at times and, you know, one would say, "Oh, you didn't do anything at slip all day," Gus would say. And Embers would say, "Well, if you bent your back, I might have had a chance," or something, you know. So it went like that a bit.
I think it's an interesting point where Angus brought up, actually, quite a few years after I'd finished, was that I always complained that Angus bowled, his spells were too long. And I felt that there are times in a match that I should be bowling when the wicket was turning and I wanted to get hold of the ball and it was a little bit harder and had a nice seam on the ball. And Angus's argument was that, you know, if once he came off, he felt that he wasn't going to get back on to bowl again, because when I came on to bowl, I would be bowling majority of the day. And I never saw it that way. I just probably on a more personal thing, saw it that I was the one that felt that I should have been bowling the situation, the match situation, and not Angus. And there'd be other times when when I would bowl, and I felt, well, I don't look like getting a wicket here. I feel as if the batsmen are milking me, and I wasn't looking as though I was being penalized enough. And I'd go up to Gat and say, look, Gat, I don't think I'm doing a particularly good job here in terms of keeping it tight. I don't feel as if, or I don't look as though I'm getting a wicket. They look to be milking me. And I would say to Gat, look, take me off for 20 minutes, bring me on Rubbish. The other end, but take me off. And I did used to say that to Gat. But Angus, because we bowled at the same end at the pavilion end, would you know, his answer was, well, if I come off, I'm not going to get back on again, which is, you know, we're all there as bowlers. You bowl to get wickets. You know, I played cricket to get wickets, score runs and take catches.
You didn't. You bowled to bloody bowl maidens most of the time.
Well, I wasn't a big spinner of the ball, so I couldn't just bloody bowl here, there and everywhere. I got twatted all over the place. So therefore, I had to rely on the skills and the strengths that I had, which is control over line and length, and I would set my fields accordingly. I could have a couple of men around about and put pressure on. If the batsman then wanted to play a shot and be aggressive towards me, I'd drop a man back to deep mid-wicket or have a long on. And
your
just
field placing, your field placing was ridiculous, though. It was like which blade
of grass, an inch, one way or the other.
Yeah, which blade of grass do you want me on here? I mean, it was just theatre.
Even in benefit matches.
I always worried about you fast bowlers, about not having cricket awareness, that when a bowler bows over the wicket and you pick position, that when he goes round the wicket, you know, you don't think about moving a little bit wider. You just stand there. So therefore, you need a little bit of a nudge to go wider.
The problem was, I'd, well, often take the new ball from the pavilion in, and after, in my second over, all of a sudden, ball's going through to Keith Brown, who's Embers is saying, give me the ball. And you can see Embers, I mean, I've got some balls here. He's sort of getting in his hand to see whether he can grip it yet. And I was thinking, bloody hell, I'm not going to get many overs here because Gat's at first slip. And the closest I got to try to influence Gat was at fine leg. So I had no chance with him in the captain's ear. It's like, oh, get me on. He's not doing much. Hang on, I've only missed second over. Give us a chance. I'm getting loose.
You've answered Catherine Goebel's question about transferring from playing to written press. She also adds, was there any journalist who helped you get through that? I remember I actually sent you a copy of the Roger's Thesaurus, and somebody defaced it, and they put where it's the word for obese, they crossed out obese and wrote Gat, and then there was... They, for parsimonious, they crossed out parsimonious and put Tufnell and things like that. But I don't know, was there anybody who'd done the transition who did help you? And you don't have to say me, by the way. I probably wasn't much of a help anyway.
I think when I went there was a bit, not animosity, but there was a bit of one of the lucky things about it is you walk straight into a good position, and there's a lot of people there who've tried to come through local media, writing for local papers, and one day wanted to be the cricket correspondent for a newspaper. So you're sort of flew past a lot of people who put a lot of hard work in. So there wasn't resentment, but there was a bit of hang on, because other players had done it and maybe not treated the job seriously. But the fact that I suppose it's the way you work and did treat it seriously, did work hard, did turn up to all the press conferences, did attend everything that I was supposed to attend, quickly sort of not won the other cricket journalists over, but they respected and they were very, very helpful and very understanding. And it's strange, actually, and Simon, both Simons would know that. I mean, when big stories break, everybody's looking for an exclusive or an angle, but at times you're working as a group because everybody's got to go out and try and find, you phone him, and we'll share the quotes type of thing, because you're just trying to get to the bottom of what's taking place. So even though you are working for individual companies at times, you are working like a team, or you do feel that you are a team travelling around the world trying to cover the England games. And it was really good fun. I mean, the only reason I sort of packed it in really was a lifestyle decision, just spending so much time away from home. Your children are suddenly in their early teens. You want to spend some time with them. It's not much fun for your wife, is it, sort of sat at home whilst you're gallivanting around the world. So it was a combination of lifestyle and the Middlesex job became available. So I changed. It wasn't the fact that I didn't enjoy what I was doing, for sure.
Have you ever missed it, Gus?
Yeah, a lot of the times when Middlesex have been batting like a bag of shit. I still enjoy sitting down, and if I don't do as much now, but a story would break sort of when I immediately after I left the Independent, and they'd say, "Oh, could you do something on something?" And you'd do it, and to sort of sit down for 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon and put 800 words together is something that I enjoyed, and I still enjoy. Actually, I still enjoy. Sounds quite sad writing sort of reports and things like that, because, and you get very anal about punctuation and things. I was never sort of much of an English student at school. I got a C in my O level, but I hate poor punctuation. I hate texts that aren't punctuated correctly. So my years as a journalist sort of, I think that there was a lot of good things that came out of it, in the way that I don't know, the use of language again, and to, and all these sort of little things that sort of that you should do, and they become quite important.
How would you cope with the World Cup deadline last summer, Gus? You know, the super over, and the, you know, in the gloom, the late finish at Lord's, so you didn't quite know it was going. Right, at one stage, it was going clearly New Zealand's way, wasn't it? And then obviously England had that dramatic victory. How do you cope with that?
Lots of rewrites and good subs.
Last summer, Embers can come in on this as well. What was the most dramatic, exciting for you? What engaged you most? Ben Stokes is miracle of Headingley that last day, or the World Cup final? What you know, when you look at those two events, which do you prefer, or which you know got you going most out of those two?
I was a guest of the MCC for the World Cup final, which was just an amazing day. But I just sat in the corner of our lounge, sort of thinking the test match against Australia was going to be over, and just watching the last wicket. And then my wife was in one corner, my son was in the other, and I was sort of by the door, just because I'd been outside doing bits and pieces. And we just sat there for however long it was, an hour or so. No one said a word to each other. It was just transfixed by genius, wasn't it? I mean, it to see Ben Stokes play as he played then was genius. It was a bigger test of him than the World Cup, even though, I mean, you can't belittle a World Cup win, which is unbelievable. But what he produced at Headingley that day was just stunning, absolutely stunning. You were just watching you knew you were watching a great moment in the history of the game, really, or a great hour in the history of the game.
Yeah, and you could also argue as well that the World Cup final, I mean, it threatened to be a damp squib, didn't it, for a long time? I mean, New Zealand batted quite slowly. They got a score on the board. They were very pragmatic. England really struggled to come to terms with the pitch. There was that weight of expectation. And then it did come alive in that last, well, almost, I mean, almost in the last over, really, with that deflection that went for, you know, allowed England to get six runs. Whereas Headingley was, there was something, I don't know, there was something sort of otherworldly about Headingley that you'll never experience again, I think, in a strange way. The noise of the crowd, if you're there, the noise of the crowd, people having sort of the day out of their lives. I know they were at Lord's as well, but in a way, it wasn't a great match, the World Cup final. It was a fantastic conclusion.
A test for me is almost, you're in the car, you're driving around, and whether you're listening to Test Match Bash, and a repeat of the commentary sort of has appeared, and the hairs on your neck stand up more when Jonathan Agnew was describing, I think, who was the bowler? Was it Cummins running into bowling?
Cummins, Stokes, yeah.
Then the run out. It's one of those moments where you just, and the roar and the reaction, it was just, that was brilliant, sort of,
Theatre, yeah. But just going back, Embers, you're back with us, I think. Just going back to the World Cup final, we were talking about the tension there. You actually had an incredibly calm demeanour. At the end of this one game, a one-day match against Zimbabwe for Middlesex, in which they were 260 for four, needing one run to win off the last over of a 50-over game. You bowled it, and it was a double wicket maiden. And I think it was either a tie or we won by one run. Do you think, and you bowled, I remember you bowled six virtually perfect Yorkers. Do you think that is an underused ball now in one-day cricket?
Well, I think everyone, you know, former players that watch the game feel that there are not enough Yorkers bowled towards the end of the innings, particularly in 2020 cricket. And I still think if a side needs 18 or 20 runs chance to win, it's still the best option to win the game as opposed to bowling the ball back of the length and being able to get hit 360 out of the ground. The Zimbabwe situation, game, yeah. I think that was more about Zimbabwe cocking it up rather than me bowling a really good last over. And there's no way that you could bowl a last over and not go for a single
run. I mean, yeah,
that's just crazy. But that was in 1980.
Yeah,
you know, when
the game has sides moved on a bit, I suppose.
Sides did play the game totally different. Now, you know, I every bowler is exposed in one day cricket and 2020 cricket in particular.
Embers is a magnificent bowler. I mean, the control he had, what he could do, is far higher than so many bowlers of his era and of modern times. And I talk fondly of a Middlesex pre-season tour. Obviously, money was tight. I think we went to Jersey or Guernsey. We had some funny places. Well, Vale de Lobo as well, but we won't talk about that.
No, we better not talk about that. That's an after-hours just conversation. Go on, carry on.
We're doing a middle of an innings, sort of working, knocking the spinners around training session in on this pitch, early season pitch in Jersey or Guernsey. I can't remember it was. So Tufnell and Paul Weeks are bowling, and it's all gone very constructively. We've got a lot out of it. They're knocking it around for five and over, and it all looks good. And eventually we got to the session, we could do with a bit more. Could we sort of set up another little scenario? And Weeksy had had enough, and Tuff has had enough. So Ember said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll bowl. So anyway, he's come on, and he's bowled six overs, 3 for 7 or something like that, and completely buggered the session up. The batsmen didn't know what to do. They've gone from sort of having some idea about what was going on by working tough and all weeks around and being constructive to you coming on and just making them look absolutely foolish. And it completely buggered the session up because you were a magnificent bowler.
Well, I had my strength was I had good control over line and length. I wasn't a big spinner, but I had good control over line and length.
Right, we've lost him again. I think
it's
interesting, actually. I mean, if he comes back, maybe this is the technology saying, Embers, you need to cut your stories a bit shorter. but he did actually, he justifiably would say it was a shame they didn't have DRS in Embers' day because his test wickets, 130 or something test wickets, and only about 10% were LBW, whereas Swan, someone like that, similar kind of bowler, 30% of his wickets LBW playing in a DRS era. So he justifiably, I mean, I can still see Embers now actually appealing for LBW when a batsman just blocked it and hit on the pad, didn't really move his feet much, hit right in front of middle, and the umpire was sort of giving it not out because of the stride for some pathetic reason. And Embers is, you know, this is a family show, so we can't say what he actually said, but I mean, there was a lot of F's.
He always sort of said, if that was a CB, you'd have got that. It'd have been given out. That's what is his line. Yeah. And he used to, not in an aggressive, horrible way, he'd be in front of the beat every other week now, though, because you can't say a word to an umpire.
Imagine that. Imagine him and his Tourette's syndrome now. He'd have been banned, you know, long ago, wouldn't he? He'd have had so many demerit points. Just for sort of sly comments. Gus, can we? I asked you to pose a question. We should give people a bit of time because we've probably got another 10 minutes. We started a bit late, so probably got about another 10 minutes. You've got a question. The idea of this question is something that you can't look up, hopefully, and we'll give you 5-10 minutes to answer it. And then if somebody gets it right, the first person to get it right wins. This week, we're going to give you a special prize. This is the prize this week. This is genuine, you know, £50 note. That's for the person who gets the answer first, provided you can send us your bank details or your, you know, some kind of way of getting hold of you. And we'll ask you for an email address later. But Gus, what is your question?
Well, I'm a bit worried now. This is a bit too random. So
that's all right, because we can roll over if the people don't get it this week.
No one gets it. We can roll over to next week. Yeah.
I mean, T20 is talked about as a form of the game that only started in 2002, but of course it was a form of the game that we played as kids at school. And in Harrow, there was a competition called the Mayor of Harrow's, which was an evening 20 over knockabout. I played in the final for that for Stanmore. I can't remember the exact year, but when I was in my sort of late teens, and it was on a Thursday evening at Harrow Town. I took 5 for 25 in 6 overs, yet Stanmore lost the game. because you could bowl six overs. I don't know. It was, that's the way that it was sort of. But which side did Stanmore lose to in that match? So it's okay. Something that's quite sort of. Is that too random, yours?
Well, no, I don't think so. So how many?
It was a well-known T20 side in Harrow that used to play at a recreational ground.
Right. Okay. And so it was a well-known side in Harrow playing in a recreational ground. This is, but they weren't a Middlesex League team or whatever.
No, they're a West Indian side.
Okay. Right. So see if anybody can come up with that answer. Ember says he's still here. I think I don't know if I've got to invite him back again or something. I'll try. Reconnect. I don't know. I don't know what's happened to him.
Simon, you owe someone some money.
Has somebody got it already?
Who's got it? Derek Tomlin or Jacob Matthews?
Derek Tomlin.
Derek Tomlin. Well done.
And the answer is
Starlight.
Starlight, yeah. Which was probably you gave it away a bit because they're probably about the only West Indian team in West London, weren't they? Okay, well, so Derek Tomlin, who got that answer correct, brilliant. Well done for your knowledge. Not to com. Why are you laughing?
Because Derek was the organizer of the competition.
Oh God!
I know, sorry, Derek.
I didn't realise that.
I see.
Well, that's okay. So that's all right. It's lucky. Thank God he was on. Derek, make sure you ask your next week when we get a Stuart Broad or a Joe Root on. Please make sure you get all your league colleagues on as well, so we get more numbers. We want more people. We've done really well, actually. We've got 80 people tonight. Thank you very much, everybody, for joining. But we want to double it and triple it because little announcement here. Subsequently, we're going to do this every Thursday night. And we're going to be raising money for the PCA fund, or it's actually now called the Professional Cricketers Trust, which is a fund to help disabled or people, cricketers who've fallen hard times, or people who've got injured and in some way and unable to work, or are in suffering, you know, bad depression or whatever. So we are going to start raising money on this site each week for the Professional Cricketers Trust. And I'll make sure that's clear on social media and on various other platforms so everybody knows about it. But, Derek, try and get as many of your colleagues on as possible. Because, Gus, actually, you know, serious point for a minute. You are, I know, concerned to an extent about how players are going to be this winter with no opportunity to go away, you know, possibly difficulty sort of getting out that much under new lockdown rules, which obviously have just been introduced in London. So is that a concern, and what kind of things are you going to do?
It is. And I mean, normally, so players meet up in March. They're all excited, had a winter away, looking forward to the summer. By October, at the end of the season, they've had enough of it, need some space. They go away on holiday for 2 weeks in October. They have a week messing around Northwest London. And in November, they start training again. After the season we've had, they've not had enough of each other. They wanted the season to continue when it ended in September, at the end of September, early October. They can't get away in October. There's limited stuff of what they can do now around their home in October, and they're very keen for almost us to be organising things and getting things going. So I think we're going to have to work hard. Our counties are going to have to work hard, and they should be working hard to look after the players, to make sure they're engaged, to give them stuff to do. And it's not all about training. I mean, we've got a lunch where a few players are coming. We're trying to set lunches up and things like that. Obviously, what we can do is limited at the moment, but to do social things as and when we can, as well as physical preparation for the coming season. So. I don't know whether some players have struggled around the country or not, but fortunately, most of our players seem in reasonable shape, and we want that to continue.
Just about the winter ahead, actually, I've got some breaking news that the Pakistan Cricket Board has invited England to play a white ball tour to Pakistan during the early part of 2020. 21. So presumably in January, it's obviously got to be looked at, and all sorts of things have got to happen before it does happen. The ECB says we'll be liaising with the Pakistan Cricket Board as well as our other partners over the coming weeks to work through these considerations before a final decision will be taken in due course. So just the possibility there of England returning to play international cricket in Pakistan. Of course, Pakistan came over to England this summer, and which, you know, the English game was hugely grateful for that happening, and, you know, it made a huge financial difference. But the possibility of England going to Pakistan for some white ball cricket in the new year.
I think the winter, from what I gather, there's obviously the IPL's. How long is it going for? About another month? Is it?
Finals on the 10th of November. 10th of November.
England are then going to South Africa, or due to go to South Africa, aren't they?
We think that's not, that's uncertain now, though.
November, December. Then in January, I think it's Sri Lanka.
Yeah, but that's uncertain as well. I mean, the Sri Lanka tour is uncertain because the Sri Lanka government want everybody to isolate for 2 weeks before when they arrive, and the ECB are not necessarily going to agree to that. Pakistan look as if they might want to step in instead of the South Africa tour, instead of the Sri Lanka tour. Simon, having delivered that piece of news, you back up what Jacob Matthews said. Simon there, he says, I wanted to say Simon Mann is the most well-informed commentator, which shows he knows what he's talking about. But then he says, and Simon Hughes's cricket knowledge is second to none. So maybe not. And also, I just want to point out that Derek, who won that prize, Derek Tomlin, has said, after saying he was the organiser of the competition, he says, please give the 50 quid to the Ruth Strauss Foundation. So that's a brilliant effort. Thank you very much, Derek, for that. We will do that for sure. And we'll try and get Straussy on as well if he'll actually get him to answer any of his texts. He's not that good at answering. So now, Gus, the other thing I asked you is probably me. Gus, one other question I had for you, which I don't know if you had time to do this, a favourite piece of memorabilia maybe.
I don't know. I've got, say, as you can see in the shelves behind me, there's lots of clutter and stuff. I mean, I've just looked in my cupboard there, and there's a couple of caps there, just an England cap, sort of from my early days. And this is a cap I love. It's sort of almost caps. Caps are a big thing to me because caps, at the end of your career, your collection of caps will show where you've been, what you've achieved, who you played for, and it will sort of, and each of the club caps tells a story. And the older and tattier the caps are, the better stories they have. And this is a sort of cap that, it was an England touring cap.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, we went through this stage where they were like those. They weren't traditional caps. They were, but they weren't the sort of plastic things. We had, I don't know, these caps were produced, and that was one I wore on two or three England tours. So it's pretty old and tatty and knackered. And I suppose that tells, well, days when you were fitter, healthier, and.
Days when you were fitter and healthier.
And a lot better shape than you are now. So my dad used to look after us. That was a ball I got a hat-trick with against Sussex in the Benson Edges game in 1988. There are other balls here. Actually, that was
excellent, the
ball I got five for against the West Indies in.
Excellent. You've been tampering with that a bit, haven't you? You scratched that. No, you lifted the quarter seam.
That's how it was after the game. Shh.
Oh, brilliant.
And then these balls with huge seams that were used in 98. People wonder why I did well in the West Indies in 98. It's because they had an old stock of balls that had huge seams on them. And you can probably see.
Yeah, you can. You can see, definitely. Yeah, how much bigger. It's fatter, isn't it? And it's like a piece of rope that going around the middle of the ball.
It was. And that's why I was effective there rather than other places. Probably.
Okay. Oh, brilliant. Well done. Listen, I think we should call it a close. I'm sure everyone's ready for their dinner now. So I think we're done, actually, aren't we? Just to sum up, we are looking to do this every Thursday from now on from 7 o'clock, unless you suddenly all complain on the chat that it's the bad time. But hopefully Thursday nights is the best time. We want to try and get this conversation going. Let's get lots of different guests on, some current players, some ex-players, and just give you the opportunity to ask questions, maybe even come up on screen as Embers did there with his headset, which maybe needs a bit of attention. Gus, thank you very much for your time tonight. What's in store for you over the next couple of weeks?
contracts.
right.
I suppose we're trying to work out the finances and the position that we're in and what we cannot commit to, really, moving forward. So
I suppose you've had to deal with the one or two releases, have you? I mean, players that have come to the end of their contracts and you're not going to renew them, sort of thing?
Only one, really, this year. Right. So we've got managed a lot of players up at the end of next year, and which ones we look to extend and which ones we can't, because I think a lot of counties are going to be looking at their finances quite closely and hoping, if there are no Crows next year, there's going to be some real tough decisions to make, I feel. So it's preparing for those, really, so that you've got a bit of flexibility should Crowds not be allowed. If Crowds are back in, and hopefully that'll be the case, then I think everybody can move along with a lot more confidence. But at this moment in time, everybody's quite wary of where they're going to be in a year's time, really.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks. Listen, thanks for everybody that's turned up tonight. You all seem to have enjoyed it. Rob Kelly says Thursday at 7 p.m. is good. So glad to know that. Steve Parry, great chat tonight. Thank you all. We've had messages from Neil, from Stu, from Jeff Wellstead, says great session, chap. So really glad you enjoyed it. This is just a little advert for the current issue of the Cricketer magazine, which, as you can see, features our friend Sir Geoffrey as the cover feature. He's 80 next week. So the podcast, our analyst podcast, will be the second part of his interview, which is coming up probably on Monday. I'll release that. And we'll also put this together as a podcast as well. So if you hadn't heard all of it or you missed some of it or whatever, hopefully we'll upload that later as well. Anyway, Gus, thank you very much for your time and your contributions tonight. I know there's been no crowds at cricket this year, so there's a little bit of applause for you. And we'll just say goodbye. And as I said to you before, 7 p.m. every Thursday night is what we're doing from now on. The Analyst Inside Cricket, the virtual cricket club. So please tell your friends about it. Men and women and boys and girls, we want as many people as possible on here. Look at Gus with his England cap on. Doesn't he look fantastic? Gus, thank you very much for allowing me to get the Middlesex sweater on again for the first time for a long time. Thank you very much, everybody, for joining us, and join us at this time again next week. See you
then. Bye. Thanks very much. Goodbye.
Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.